This episode of TWIM is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover makes domain name registration and management simple. For Hover's transfer concierge service, free for our audience, go to hover.com/TWIM. Hey everyone, welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex, and we have a illustrious crew here with us today. Tim Street. Hey Tim.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Are you in LA?
I am in liquid sunshine, Southern California today.
I hear it's kind of chilly.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's May, and it feels like summer in San Francisco.
Also, coming in, Brady Brim DeForest. Brady, where are you coming in from?
You know, Alex, I'm in LA as well, and it is raining.
See, look at that. It's raining there. It's raining here, too, so it's in Petaluma. And from just slightly south of... I'm sorry, I almost jumped into what I tell my son, which is... anyway, it's something else. Slightly south of that.
Hope it has nothing to do with toilet training.
No, it has nothing to do with that. It has to... No, never mind. So, but I say that all the time, and I almost went into autopilot. But also just slightly south of Petaluma is Dane Golden. Hey, Dane.
Hey, how are you, San Francisco?
Yes. I think of that as slightly south. I mean, yep. It's 35 minutes, 25 minutes if you're in a rush. But you really can't get there faster than 25 minutes from Petaluma, just in case people are wondering. Anyway, but we've got a great lineup of stories. First up, it is free movies on YouTube. Now, this is according to the Examiner and Ted Elgin. He says that, you know, this is now, of course, this is set up as more bad news for Netflix. YouTube has officially opened a movie vault offering a wide selection. Now you can get, you can rent movies from YouTube. You can also, there are a wide selection for free. Now these are old movies, but you know, the problem for Netflix is they have old movies too. Dane, is this really a problem for Netflix? Is this really going to be strong competition?
I hope so. Not yet. I mean, I'm looking at the movies, and other than Ghostbusters and Buena Vista Social Club, I can't think of anything I'd really want to see. But I think that they definitely have the potential, and they have the user base where they could, ideally, Google's not been very good at making deals, but they could make the deals to bring the good shows there.
Right. Tim, do you think that, have you rented any from YouTube so far? Have you watched any of the movies?
You know, I haven't done it this round. It seems like they did this about 6 months ago as well. They put a bunch of movies up. And back then, I watched, you know, some old movie that was on and available. And it was great. It was fine. But, I mean, what really excites me about this is being able to use Google TV to watch movies on my TV. So I've got to try that out.
Now, Brady, one of the things that we're seeing with YouTube, okay, so we've had all these movies and we've had music videos and a lot of corporations now have gotten into just putting up all of their stuff on YouTube. It's easier. And now you see movies being made available. We're also seeing YouTube experimenting with live streams. They're looking for mostly events, not like 24-hour services. But does it really look to you like YouTube is really building out this, you know, media, you know, just kind of touching every part of how we watch video?
Yeah, I think they're certainly trying to. I think from an industry perspective, Google is a bad faith actor in some cases. Like what they did with Google Music Beta, and so I think there's a lot of skepticism about their strategy, and I think there's a real desire for Google not to come out on top in the kind of the professional video space, at least on part of the, you know, of the studios and the network. So I think they're going to have a very difficult time securing content for YouTube.
So Dane, I have a question for you. So between, Brady, answer this one more time, and then we'll run around for everyone. But between Apple, Google, Amazon, Netflix. It feels like Hollywood is jumping. You know, they are on a very hot plate, and they are surrounded by fire. I mean, does it look like, are any of these none of these companies seem particularly interested in quote unquote helping them?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that they're in the middle of a battlefield, and they've got a lot of folks, you know, targeting them directly.
Google. Well, the question is that they're not only in the middle of it, but they don't have, they have to make partnerships with some of these folks, or one of them will take over. I mean, if they don't, you know, they get into bed too long with Apple and they take over. They get into bed too long with Netflix and they take over. So they have to spread it around, but they're spreading it around to none of these companies see eye to eye with Hollywood. They are, you know, tacitly, you know, putting up with Hollywood.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's fair. Hollywood is, kind of stuck in a mindset that really doesn't work in the digital age, so they're always kind of one step behind. But I think you're right, Alex. Is the key here is not to let any of these distribution channels come out on top and win. I think Apple's probably the closest to having already done that, but now they need to ensure that Apple doesn't stay on top. But then, you know, who replaces Apple? Is it Google? Well, that's not any better. So, for at least from the network's perspective.
And Dane, you know, one of the things we've talked about in the past on one of these shows is that when you actually look at the cash reserves of many of the companies that they're dealing with, it's not Hollywood being the big, you know, gorilla and these tech companies being just trying. You know, it used to be this way. Hollywood was these massive conglomerates, and these little tech, you know, companies were trying to, you know, scrape for the crumbs. But the reality is that Google, Amazon, Apple, you know, all of these companies could buy most of Hollywood, and it would barely show up on their sheet. Dane, does it make sense for some of these companies, like Sony did 20 years ago, to possibly just start purchasing some of these media distribution and media creation companies?
Well, you know, I said last time we talked about this, I said no. But, you know, when I look at it again and how Apple has continued to have success, at least creating these deals, I wonder how much of their success has come simply because Steve Jobs is the largest shareholder in Disney. And that
it is interesting that Disney generally you know, puts their stuff on iTunes pretty quickly.
Right, and then he demonstrates that Disney can do it, and the other guys maybe are a little bit more amenable. But I think that there's a different credo in Hollywood, and that is, it's not what you earn, it's what you negotiate, and that is not necessarily how the tech world is used to doing. They've come around and said, you know what, we'll just do what we do, it's just store things, and that's what Amazon and Google have done. Well, we'll just upload, you can just upload stuff, and eventually these folks will come around. But I wanted to ask a question of Brady, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Brady, you said Google, I think you said they were a bad faith actor. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, great question. So I think Google kind of time and again has demonstrated, at least to the content owners, and I'm paraphrasing here from conversations I've had in both the television, the film, and most recently the music world, in response to the Google Music launch, there's a perspective that that Google is going to charge ahead, to do what they want to do, regardless of what deals they ink, and then they're going to deal with it in the courts, and that they don't have a real respect for copyright. And so, as a content owner dealing with Google, there isn't a perception that Google is there to work as a partner. More like Google is there to push through their agenda to open up the web, or you know, to make a massive amount of content available, you know, for at free or no cost. So that's not necessarily my perspective on Google, but I do see that as a very common refrain that I hear within, you know, the walls of the industry.
Well, and this is another one of our stories on the docket, and we'll just jump right into it. So this is the May 10th launch of Google's Google Music, and so basically they decided to launch a music locker service, and of course, you know, people within the record labels are not particularly excited about the whole thing. A lot of this, of course, you know, came down to the things that we would expect. You know, number one is probably money that they did. They want to make sure they want a lot of money up front. I mean, labels tend to want that money up front. They don't know where this is going to go, and they want to make sure they're not losing anything. They're afraid of piracy, and it sounds like a lot of this had to do a lot with wanting. They want Google to stop linking to pirate sites. So Google is just kind of letting searches out, and they want to shape those searches away from the piracy sites. And also, I think that they're afraid of, you know, how the competition would affect things. And this is I'm just in some ways pulling out of the Hollywood Reporter, Anthony Bruno from Billboard was writing this, and so these are some of the stuff that he brought up. And so these are some of the issues that that he outlined there. It does sound like that's probably the direction that the record labels were going. And Google just said. I mean, it sounds like, you know, it sounds like with all these companies, but Google probably more than any of the other ones has been, you know, Microsoft and Apple tend to play as fair as they can. Netflix, you know, will, you know, do what it can there. Google just seems like, you know, well, we'll either sort out a solution with you or we'll take you to court. I mean, or you can take us to court. You know, that's the kind of, they have an opinion that they are ahead in the court, you know, as far as how that works, or that you can keep it in conversation for the next 2 to 3 years. Tim, do you think that might be it? Just let it run its course, and by the time we get to the other end of it, it won't matter.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be a consistent legal tactic a lot of the times.
Well, I mean, because it's devastating. I mean, the reality is that Netflix, I mean, not Netflix, but Napster, basically, you know, pushed all this stuff into, and no one capitalized on the fact that they had that large user base. But the reality is that as that damage is being done, it's very hard to roll back.
Yeah, it's hard to put the genie back into the bottle unless you have some compelling, easy way to get the content and pay for it. The same thing with music and with films always it dumbfounds me. I mean, I understand you don't want to upset the apple cart. You don't want to upset what you're currently making. But if you take a look at where stuff has been sold in the past, it hasn't just been sold at one retailer. I mean, you didn't buy everything at Walmart. You could buy it at Target. You could buy it at 7-Eleven. So the fact that you know, they're so upset about who's got what, it seems like they're just wasting their time.
Well, I think that, you know, it seems like, you know, the problem is with what Google's doing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the issue is that when you're talking about that genie coming back out of the bottle or trying to get it back in, the issue is, for instance, is once people have that experience of that music locker, what the record industry knows is that they'll be pretty darn upset if it gets taken away. So even if the record industry wins in court, they end up, you know, losing in the court of public opinion. Because, like, for instance, I have all this stuff on Netflix, and then they started pulling back on Netflix. Now, I don't feel like I want to go out and buy movies now because they took some of the movies off of Netflix or they're not showing some of those shows. I'm just mad, you know, and then I just won't watch them. You know, I just watch whatever I have on Netflix because I'm not willing to get out of that now. You know,
you're going to watch whatever is easy for you to watch.
Yeah, no, literally. I'm going to go up to Netflix. I'm going to find something that I'm going to watch. You know, and the question is whether they want to be on that or not. But once that, and it wasn't like that all the time. But once it got to a certain point where people started to use it, you know, it's one of those things that now once you get used to that, it seems like it's very, very hard to come back. Now, Brady, do you think this is a real concern for the record industry? Is that as this stuff rolls out, there's just no way to get it back, and they literally are. It appears that they possibly are in kind of a no-win situation here.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's a fear. But I also think that the content owners do believe that content is king. You hear that phrase a lot. And at the end of the day, they still own the copyright, and they can, you know, take Google to court, and they, you know, feel like they you know, there's a possibility that they can win. But I do think that there's a lot of historical bruises, you know, from the Napster and Kazaa days that, you know, has bred a real sense of fear into these guys. And so there's, you know, anything new, despite the fact that their, you know, business is coming apart at the hinges, I think that there's still a fear of anything new, and especially something that isn't coming from the music industry. You know, these outside actors that are kind of foisting solutions on them are seen with a lot of skepticism. And generally not trusted.
Now, Dane. So, do you now? Here's the question for you: do you think that content is king, or do you think community is now the new king?
I think community is the king. I think the network is your friends and the people you associate with online and follow. If you know, Facebook's done a few things with video. They had the Dark Knight on there, and you can buy that with Facebook credits. And I think that that's going to happen more and more frequently. And I think that Netflix should get into the social game as well, more than they have.
Right. So we'll see how this we'll see how this all turns out. Of course, this will just continue to roll out. It's a ugly story that's probably going to last for quite some time as we try to figure out the rules of engagement. Now, some people do think that these paywalls are going to work. The New York Times being one of them. Of course, they set up all these complicated ways of how you can view how many times you can go to the New York Times, how many articles you can read. And so far, the concern now is that it may not be working as well as they had hoped. Their share of website traffic was 10.6% last month, down from 13% in March and 13.5% a year ago. So the report, according to Ad Age, is that their overall page views have dropped 24%, while unique visitors are off 13%. Now, New York Times says, of course, this is all based on a slow news month in April. But Brady, do you think that this paywall that the New York Times has put up is it working, or is it pulling money in, or is it keeping people out?
Well, you know, I think digital revenues never really quite caught up after the recession in terms of online ad dollars for most of the major newspapers, and so I think they wanted to do something. The paywall certainly affects traffic. I can't imagine that it doesn't, although there are a lot of loopholes and ways around that for end users. It's pretty simple to access any content you want on nytimes.com, but I think it's still probably too early in the experiment to determine if, you know, users are ponying up the cash to pay. I know that they've had a lot of hundreds of thousands of folks subscribe, so that's a good sign. And I don't think that it takes much in terms of subscribers for them to kind of come to level with the digital ad dollars that they're losing from the paywall. So I think probably overall it's net a plus, but that's just a guess without having looked at their books.
Dane, do you think that these smaller number of subscribers are paying better than the ad dollars?
Paying better than the ad dollars, I don't know, but I think if after putting up a paywall they only lost 3% of the online market, I think that's remarkable. So I think that's actually a success. They certainly were going to lose some. Now, how much does that mean? 10% are still paying? I don't think so, but I think that that's actually a good number for them. That sounds good.
Tim, do you think that this is, do you think that overall these kind of paywalls are going to make sense for publishers?
Yeah, except for like the digital ad sales guy. I think I'd hate to be those guys,
Right.
What? What are you guys doing? That's going to kill my commission.
Well, so, wait. Let me ask a question, Tim. Do you think they know more about their users, and can they charge more because they know more about their subscribers because they have to log in?
I think they do. You're right there. In terms of if they do know who they're targeting and they know more information, they can raise their CPMs. So eventually it will become more valuable to the ad sales team. But I think in the interim, they're going to have to suck it up a little bit.
Well, another thing that the magazines and the newspapers, periodicals have traditionally done is actually sell that subscriber data. And that was something that they're missing without subscribers. So I think that's actually a whole other revenue stream that they're going to be able to leverage again.
And it's a different level. It's people who are truly interested because they're paying for it. I mean, they're definitely a more valuable market than just people who are just kind of going by. I have to admit that it has affected my viewership. I haven't even hit the wall, but I realized that I suddenly had this thing like New York Times is not available in my head just from the news that came out. Mm-hmm. But I've gone up to it a couple times, and it's all there. But I always feel like, well, if I hit it too many times on stupid articles, I'm not gonna if I see one that I really want to read, I'm not going to be able to read it because I don't want to, you know, go through that process.
And what about our advertisers and sponsors?
What about our advertisers and sponsors? We have one. we'd like to thank, of course, our sponsor, Hover.com. Hover is just an easy, simple way to get your domain name registration if you want to have a paywall or not. You know, it doesn't matter to Hover because they're not going to manage that for you. In fact, they're not going to have all these other extras that you get. The gauntlet that you try to kind of work your way through is really, really a painful process. I don't know if you've gone to some of these other sites, but you start signing up and then they want to know if you want camels with that. I think there's actually a selection there for camels.
One hump or two.
Exactly. And so there's just this gauntlet of things that they're asking for. Here's what Hover does. They handle your email addresses. They handle your domain. That's it. So they stay very, very focused on the things that you want to do when you're trying to register something. They also have great services to help you transfer. The domain transfers are free. And so you can kind of figure that out. They have, they basically focus on just the things that you want to do. Now they also, have a no hold policy. So this is crazy thing that it used to happen, back, in the last century, and they brought it back, which is that when you call on the phone, you'll actually talk to a person, not a recording of a person that asks you to talk it back to the computer where it tries to figure out what you're doing, but a real live person. They won't put you on hold 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern. So if you need to talk to someone and you can't figure out how to get this all to work, Hover's there to help you. So definitely check it out. And if you want to get 10% off, you can use the offer code TWIM. So go to Hover, HOVER.com/TWIM, and use the offer code TWIM to get 10% off your registration.
I used it. It worked.
Did it work?
It worked.
And it wasn't painful?
Wasn't painful. I did it.
Also, the added bonus that their CEO does not murder elephants.
It's what? No. Oh, their CEO does not.
Not murder elephants, yeah.
Yeah, there was a thing about another CEO that was shooting elephants. I will say, as someone who works in Zimbabwe, it's kind of complicated. The issue there, we'll just go down a rat hole for about 60 seconds. The issue with the whole GoDaddy thing and the owner shooting elephants, there's a lot of people that shoot elephants in Zimbabwe. The problem that they did is to build up tourism, what they do is they put too many water holes out there, because water holes, I shoot at these places, and the water holes attract all the animals. The problem is that it created a extremely large elephant population. The last number I heard in the northern part of Zimbabwe, Botswana, and southern part of Zambia, it's 180,000 head of elephant. And in addition to them starving to death, they cause a lot of damage. You know, they're big. They eat a lot of food. Sure. They eat a lot of the locals' food, and they actually kill people. So it's a so a lot of these hunts are controlled hunts that are there to cull the herd. That's how that it's all work. It's all a process with the government. And
I have no doubt. I think pushing that video on Twitter, yeah, though, may have been a step too far.
It is. It is. It's, as I said, but I to give him a little bit of, it's not quite as rough as it sounds. Someone's going to do it. And what they did is they raised additional revenue to support a lot of the processes by having, rich people come in and do it rather than paying guys to go out and do it.
And your shooting is just with a camera when you said you shoot there.
Oh, yeah. When I go, I'm just shooting with cameras. I don't go hunting. I haven't.
Although you have been known to shoot guns.
Oh, yeah, no, I shoot a lot of guns. I just don't shoot them at anything living anymore. I like to target shoot and everything else. But the bigger picture there is that they're, I don't want to, you can decide, listeners can decide whether it's good or bad or all those other things. But it's a series of unfortunate events that have been created. It's one man-made event that was created by another man-made event. And they're kind of zigzagging back and forth on that, and so I know guys who actually have gone on these hunts, and I know guys that shoot the behind the scenes for them, and the thing is that every part of that elephant, it's not like they're just taking the tusks and going away like a poacher would. Every part of that elephant is used by the local villagers, so all the meat goes back into the local, everything is used up, It's as careful as they can make it. It's better than poaching, and it has to. They can't. It's just an unsustainable size. There are a lot of animals that are dying out in Africa, and the elephants in Southern Africa are not one of them. So anyway, so that's the, and I, you know, I just wanted to make sure. I grew up in the country. You know, we're kind of, you know, I grew up hunting. I don't hunt anymore, but I grew up doing it. And oftentimes I have to go off on a little side trail there, where, you know, because sometimes the headline is a lot. It seems worse than it actually is. So anyway, in my opinion. Maybe there in your go. Opinion, it doesn't matter.
That makes sense. Yeah.
so there, but it's a bigger story. And so anyway, back to stealth. Facebook is not so stealthy campaign against Google. So this is according to the SFGate. Facebook, you know, has, you know, it turns out that they went to a public relations firm and planted negative stories about Google in some of their competing services. Obviously, Facebook feels a little threatened by Google and decided that they would, you know, they really wanted Google to appear as the bad guys. And of course, Facebook appears the good guys and, you know, didn't really work that way. Tim, can you give us a little bit more? What were they actually doing? What were they planting there?
Well, you know, they had a PR firm going to different news organizations and trying to talk them into getting different stories out about Google. I don't think they thought this through, and they got caught red-handed with it. I think it was USA Today was like, "Hey, that's not going to happen here."
Brady, do you think that is this the way these always end? It's like, you know, you always hear this, and then they hired a PR firm to dig dirt up. you know, it seems like, you know, once you start, you know, shoveling, you know what, it tends to get on everything, right?
Yeah, I think it always comes back to you. I think if you play dirty, there's a higher probability you're going to end up, you know, damaging yourself at some point along the way. So I think that it's interesting that Facebook would make a decision to do this. You wonder how much of this was a PR strategy that was you know, driven by the PR firm as opposed to Facebook. But yeah, it kind of makes them look pretty silly.
Dane, do you think that they were bringing up real problems that needed to be addressed? I mean, was it something that were they trying to bring stuff up from thin air, or do you think that this was actually things that were worth discussing? Was there any veracity to their claims?
No. The best article that I saw on this last week was from Danny Sullivan of Search Engine Land, and he said that the reason that Google, although they're not scraping anything that's behind Facebook's wall or anyone's wall, the reason that this data is open is because Facebook is encouraging people to put their friends list open. So the finger actually points back to Facebook.
Right. So it was all, yeah, so it's, so anyway, so it, they're just kind of, you know, it was all propped up. It seemed to make sense, but maybe not so much. It doesn't sound like it does.
If you've ever searched on Google, I don't have my friends list open, but if you have your Twitter list connected to your Google profile, you'll see that Twitter, you know, Alex Lindsay recommends whatever, has linked
right
to whatever. And that's what you'll see. And that's what they're talking about, is the incorporation of your various linked networks that are public where someone is linked to something. Bing, in fact, just announced recently that they're including Facebook results in their search engine. And I think that that's what Facebook was angling towards. Bing can do it. Google cannot.
Right, right. So we'll see. We'll see if that how that turns out. It definitely did not make Facebook look particularly good. But you know, I think all of these companies, once they get, they, you know, everybody's a shining star until they get big enough where they start trying to protect their little area, their little island, and then they look like everybody else. So anyway, those were the big stories of the week. One of the things that I'm going to ask you guys, this wasn't on our notes. I got a little obsessed with something over the weekend. The people who are listening might have saw me Twitter about it. It was more. I got obsessed with the business model of, from a media perspective, of this band. And I know, okay, people are going to make fun of me because I know I'm probably like a year behind. But you know, Sometimes, you know, I'm an old guy and I don't get all this stuff immediately. But have you guys seen the Pomplamoose stuff? Have you heard of Pomplamoose?
I'm following your tweet right now.
Oh, okay. So if you haven't, So this is for the listeners. Check this out. Now, the thing is on top of being an interesting band on YouTube, I just found it fascinating how it was all working. So the science of what they're doing is something that I think that other bands could do if they were as talented as this band. So here's what happened is that a couple of us were talking about the fact here's the breakdown here is a couple of us were talking about how much the Angry Birds theme sounds like Willy Wonka, from the new Willy Wonka, Willy Wonka, so we were talking about that. And so I went to YouTube to see if I could find both of them at the same time so that we could play them back and forth and compare them, one to the other. And when we did that, when I searched Angry Birds, we saw Angry Birds covered by, it was just one of the things listed was covered by Pamplemousse. And Pamplemousse, I guess, means grapefruit in French. And it's a San Francisco band, and it's really good. I mean, if you haven't heard it, it's really well done, and it's a funny video, and it's put together. So, and then, of course, it's really well put together. At the end, it tells you where to go, and you can go see something else, and they have a little ad and everything else. And I just thought, it's a little extra that this band did. Well, as I started looking at it closer, it is actually, this is what this band does. So it's a duo, and they, their big one that has been much bigger, and they got them on NPR and everything else was they covered Single Ladies by Beyonce. And they're doing everything legally. They go to Harry Fox and they get the mechanical rights, and then they cover these songs. Now they've done a bunch of their own songs, which are really good. But they also do these covers. And the interesting thing about their model is it's not like they're getting a couple views. They're not getting 10,000 or 20,000 views. Single Ladies got 7.5 million views. The Angry Birds theme, which was released a week ago, is at 1.3 million views. I mean, they're getting a lot of views,
they're not just a cover. I mean, they're spectacle big time. I mean,
absolutely.
Pounding the guy's head on the keyboard, yeah. and they look very European. They look like a European couple.
They do, and they're in San Francisco. I want to get them on some show.
Awesome.
And the thing is, so when I was listening to the interview and I was doing more research, they make the. They literally live, their environment for how they produce music is YouTube. I mean, it's not like they haven't burned any CDs. They don't go on tours. They're doing a little tour right now, but they don't really do a lot of live music. They literally build the videos recording the music in one of their bedrooms, and so it is it's this spectacle that they put together a couple of their rules is everything here you see at some point in time in the video. So every sound is represented. And now here's the thing is that they also are tying in a lot of, so that they shoot, they'll like shoot a whole bunch of the videos are shot with Samsung cameras. Obviously they made some money on that. And they're getting ads. They were one of the first bands to get the 50-50 ad sharing with YouTube. So when they get all those views, they're actually making money on that. And they're making, this is what they do for a living, is to make these songs, create their own, doing what they're doing and putting it out. And, they say it takes about a week from the time they write the song to have something up on YouTube, and which is really interesting. And they're doing it all themselves. I mean, they're doing the video, they're doing the, I think they're doing the video themselves, but they're definitely doing most of it, all the music, a lot of the editing. They're pulling all this together, so they're very. I will say that they are extremely talented to be able to put all this stuff together, and not every band can make that actually happen. And they are quirky, which is the kind of band that would succeed here. But I just thought we talk so much about like what is the next business model, and do bands need these big labels to put this together? And I just thought it was, when you look at it, it's this mixture of truly original covers. I mean, these are, these covers that they do are very, they make it their own, they also are doing their own stuff. But in interviews, they're like, hey, we don't want to, they're not looking to be the next big band with a stadium tour. They're really happy that they get to do what they love to do at their own, with no one telling them what to do. And they're able to put it together. And I got to say, for a band, this is unusual for a band. For a band to not have a heavy duty music producer and sound as tight as they do is fairly impressive. So anyway, have you any of you guys seen this stuff?
Tim, yeah, yeah,
I'm watching. Awesome. I'm watching it right now.
Yeah,
it's fun. It's just fun. I mean, that's all it is. It's fun.
Yeah, it's as a you know, as a, if you're out there listening to the show and you want to see, you know, models, I mean, you can see that this is something that they, you know, really built towards. I don't know what they were doing before this, but they, you know, they're obviously, you know, they obviously have a lot of technical chops. They obviously have incredible music chops. And she has a great voice, which obviously makes a difference. And, but it's just, I find it to be a fascinating, phenomenon, that I found kind of, interesting and worth bringing up. You know, do you, Brady, do you think this is the kind of thing that other bands could take advantage of?
I think this is the kind of thing that YouTube is so uniquely positioned for. You know, unique sound, like Tim said, spectacle, very heavy reliance on video, kind of like the Auto-Tune guys. You know, catchy beats with great, you know, visual content. And I think that, you know, you kind of only hit lightning in a bottle once, so this is probably the only pamplemousse that you'll find on you know, making it big on YouTube. But
well, and the Let's Go guys, right?
Totally. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But I think there's a lot of bands that break on YouTube. It's like the new, you know, if I was an A&R guy, this is where I would be spending all of my time.
And it's worth it, you know, as a, you know, I think that it does require the bands, the folks in the bands, to rethink how they are, you know, rethink what they do to, and how they get out there. I mean, because I think that a traditional band with no media experience, no video experience, no editing experience might have a difficult time, you know, trying to get this done. It's because what they're doing is definitely not them just, you know, playing a song in front of a single camera. You know, this is obviously a very, you know, well-produced process. I mean, well-produced in a grunge sort of way. Dane, do you think that this is scalable? Is it something that other people could do? Is it something that someone could provide services for these people to do?
Absolutely. YouTube is a fantastic market for bands trying to get noticed, and these guys have a shtick, and that it's unique to them. But you can create your own shtick.
Right. Right. So anyway, I just thought I'd bring it up. It was one of those things that I just found very fascinating. In addition to the fact that it's, I think it's really good music. It's actually very listenable and really well produced. And I used to work in the industry, and you can definitely see these bands getting signed. You know, this band being signed, and it's clear that they don't need it. I'm going to guess that they make more money on YouTube than they would ever make this kind of music. So the style of music, they're making more money doing what they're doing here than they would ever make for a label.
Really?
And yeah. They have creative freedom.
They have complete creative freedom. They have it. Yeah. The thing is a band like this, you know, so it is great. This is my style of music. So I have to admit that I really enjoy this music, but I know from a music industry perspective, you would look at this and go, this is an alternative, you know, it's alternative rock or alternative, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, so it's going to be great in higher end college, you know, and then some of the alternative or wider format stations, you know, especially nowadays, you're not sure how many of those still, you know, it's just that's become so mainstream, you know, where everything's Lady Gaga and, you know, all this other stuff. So it'd be questionable whether they'd get enough distribution. And the problem that they'd have is that they would, the issue that they would have is they to record their album. They would be encumbered with all the costs of doing that by the record company, and then they'd be underwater for that, and all those other things, their tours and their press tours, all that stuff gets added on to what the record company was going to pay them, and so it's not really an even, you know, solution in that area. So anyway, so it's one of those things that the so when they came, they wouldn't come out the other end of it. A band of this with this kind of music probably wouldn't come out the other end of it for years. And they'd be, you know, and I think, you know, it's a perfect example of the kind of band that would probably do better. Another person who's, I think, never signed for a label, which is another example of this, is someone like Annie DeFranco, you know, who did the same thing a long time ago, 10 years ago, of, you know, but she's more like, I'm just going to play these, you know, I'm going to build my following and so on and so forth. And she owns that. And you know, these are in that alternative space, especially. I think that there's two areas. One is the alternative space. Finding things like this makes sense. If you're really big, you don't really need the record industry anymore. You know, and you know, it's the in-between. If you're a pop band that's trying to become big, I think you probably still need a label to do that. If you're not a pop band, or if you're already pop, you know, so, you know, they just have to decide whether they want to manage that or not. I think that's more of the issue. You have people like Peter Gabriel, who's completely, you know, off the reservation. I mean, he just does his own thing. He sells all of his own music. He sells all of his, you know, he manages his concert. He does all of those things himself. And I'm going to guess that he's making at least as much as he was making before, without a lot of radio airplay, without a lot of other things, because a guy like Peter Gabriel has enough of a following. A Sting would have enough of a following. To be honest, Lady Gaga would probably have enough of a following at this point. She doesn't, you know, need the record label to do that anymore. So anyway, it's just an interesting that, and then this all combined, this is of course all the pressure that's on these poor record labels, in addition to Google putting all their music in a locker. So anyway, so we'll see how it turns out. Brady, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at BradyBD or on the web at brimdeforest.com.
Dane, where can people find you?
On iTunes. Just search for Facebook This Week.
Fantastic. And Tim, where can people find you?
OneTimStreet.com or at mdialogue.com.
And a quick announcement. We are in transition at the office. We are moving all this stuff out, and there's a lot of moving parts here. So we're going to take a little bit of a hiatus. So this is the last show that we're going to do for a little while, a couple months. So we're going to take a little bit of a hiatus here while we restructure a bunch of our shows and restructure a bunch of how we're doing a lot of the pieces. It's just a chaotic time, a good time for us, but a chaotic time. So we're going to take a little time off. We have really enjoyed everything up until now. This is episode 232. We've done it 232 times, and we're just going to take a little bit of a break. And so we will all see all of you who are listening. We'll see you all soon enough. But if you're wondering if, you know, why they're not coming, we're just taking a little bit of a break for a couple months while we restructure our pipeline. So anyway, thank you very much for all the support that you've given us up until now. And we'll see you all soon. This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out. This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.